It's like a lucky charm, you know, when you push the record button and all of a sudden everybody
is as lucid and
it's as lucid
intelligent.
No, it's true. It's something changes in the air, you know. I feel myself constructing smarter sentences.
I'm a hobo CEO. Hobo CEO. My company is wherever I go. I'm a hobo CEO. I'm a hobo.
Business, lifestyle, and the philosophical implications of business whilst wearing shabby trousers, or no trousers at all.
Hello, hobos, ladies, gentlemen, bishops, squirrels, and pigeons. Welcome to a very special episode, because today we are joined by Almog.
Hello.
Hello, Almog.
Hello, Chris.
It's a pleasure to have you on board.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes.
On this board.
Indeed, because we are ensconced about a table.
Indeed.
As a board should be. So, I'm Chris Kirkland. This is
Nico Apple.
And today we will be grilling Almog with his thoughts and ruminations on...
We're going to talk about, like...
Vipassana.
Possibly, like, just fall into our conversation with... about Vipassana retreats, Almog's experiences with that.
It's a meditation form, Vipassana.
How that compares to the Kabbalah and Lucky Charms, which we covered a couple of episodes ago.
Into Lucky Charms.
Then we're going to talk about the elephant in the room.
Elephant in the phone.
In the phone.
Yes,
the elephant obviously.
In the phone.
We're going to talk about the elephant in the phone.
And then also bringing meditation practice into one's daily life.
Yep. And we had a good discussion about... something else that I'm quite happy to talk about, which is the presence process, just a method of integrating your emotions. So it's similar to meditation, but the focus is more on the emotional body rather than the mental body. That is the path that this guy recommends, Michael Brown recommends on achieving presence.
Gonna put it in the show notes.
Indeed.
So have fun.
Without further ado, the discussion.
Indeed.
Splendid.
Yeah, it was very experiential. It's a very experiential way to get spiritual wisdom rather than reading it from a book, you know, because you get a feel for it. You get a feel for how right what this new conclusion, what this new realization is. And as I was talking about it with my mom, it seemed like the ideas that she got from Kabbalah and the ideas that I got from Vipassana are almost exactly the same. I don't know who said that, but that all spiritual wisdoms, all spiritual teachings are like fingers pointing at the moon, you know? Mm. And so it's different fingers, but the destination is still the same. It's always the same moon. And so if it's two artists drawing the moon, you would still know that it's the moon.
Yeah.
And if it's two true spiritual paths that are describing the same thing, then a person could easily transition from one to the other. I just find that Kabbalah adds a lot of things that I find somewhere between ridiculous and offensive to the intelligence. Mm. I don't like that, but she seems to connect to it, so cool.
Yeah, this is so on topic for our last podcast discussion, because we came up with the idea of the power of nonsense.
Power of?
Nonsense.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically this premise that... we can't know everything intellectually or rationally, or possibly even scientifically.
Yeah.
There's certain things that we just perhaps will never be able to understand. And but we'll never be able to understand it with our mind. But maybe at some different level, we do have some kind of understanding of it. And so the first step is introducing this premise that there's this kind of gap in our understanding that rationality can't fill.
Yeah.
And the other one is the power comes in with the fact that you get things which are seemingly nonsensical and ridiculous, but there is a certain sort of power and effect and influence. And this is when Nico was coming up with the Lucky Charm idea.
Mm.
You've got your Kabbalah,
mm.
and like you kind of believe that it's kind of protecting you. It has a tangible effect on what happens.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't something you can rationally explain. It's kind of nonsense if you look at it rationally. But there are powerful effects from things which often, to rationality, appear to be nonsense. Sure. And, you know, spirituality and religion for all its nonsenseness, mm-hmm. if I can use that word.
You could, that non-word.
Yes. Has a, you know, there's very powerful effects from it.
But isn't the Kabbalah, I mean, I have only very limited knowledge about the even the basic concepts, but isn't it like a kind of a rational approach to spirituality more than like, let's say, like a physical approach? Let's say, for example, you would Tai Chi or martial arts or something like, you know? Like,
gosh, I don't know enough about Kabbalah to really... to really say, and I feel like I might come across as an ignorant, and people would be, it would be very easily possible to contradict what I'm saying.
Right.
But yeah, some of the things that go on in Kabbalah, I think they have something equivalent to the seven chakras in Indian culture.
Mm-hmm.
So they have, I think, the ten somethings, and they always almost map one to one to that. They also have a very, very, very big focus on the Hebrew language. Very big focus. So I guess it makes Kabbalah a lot more accessible to Israelis just because they could read and understand Hebrew immediately. But I think there's a concept there of the 70 names of God. And so God has 70 different names, and each name highlights a different aspect mm-hmm. of his character. So one is he's all-knowing, and another one is all-powerful. And he's everywhere, and another one is that he's all compassionate. And then when you concentrate on those letters, so this is where it gets a little weird for me, is that apparently if you concentrate on those letters, even if you don't know Hebrew, you can't read it, you don't understand what it means, just looking at those letters is supposed to put you in tune with that frequency of the divinity, which I find nonsensical.
Nonsense. Yeah.
Yeah? And also I find it redundant. You know, if you want to focus on a certain aspect of the divinity, you don't need to resort to staring at letters in an exotic language that you don't understand. Just focus on it directly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my opinion.
This reminds me a lot of my musical experiences, learning to play instruments.
Uh-huh.
One of the teachers along the way was very into fucking with my rationality.
Right.
And, like, he'd say, okay, the bass line's like this. I'd start playing it. And you go, no, it's not like that. I told you it was like this. And play something else. And it's like, that wasn't the same. And he's going, no, you're playing it wrong. And, like, keep doing things like this. He was the teacher and I was the pupil, so I'd kind of respect what he was saying, but it didn't make any sense. It was a different bass line. And this would happen all the time. This was like his way of teaching was just totally mess with my rationality and also kind of bash the ego down a bit as well.
What came of it?
And what came of it is I realized that although the bass lines were different, that wasn't really the point. What he was trying to do was to sort of switch off the rationality in my mind.
Right.
And it really worked. I mean, there are, I think, more direct ways of doing this as well, which I've later learned. But coming back to what you're saying, it's
right.
Like the kind of doing something that's kind of pointless and silly, there might actually be a deeper lesson in it. There might be more direct ways to reach it, but...
I've got a little anecdote to share on that, if I may.
Yeah.
Sure.
Have you heard of EFT?
What's that stand
for? Emotional Freedom Technique. Where people tap various areas of their body that are supposed to be in line with the Chinese meridians while saying... even though, all right, so you find like a quality about yourself or a thought that you have or something, and you repeat it in a way that you're supposed to accept it. So you say, even though I am a stupid person, I deeply and completely accept myself. Right? And obviously this is just a thought that you have going through your head, and this is supposed to help you integrate it so it doesn't have that much of an effect on you. And you're supposed to go and so you tap the side of your eyebrows and somewhere here along the nose, and they did a research on it because it does actually have some kind of measurable effect.
Yeah.
So then they wanted to see exactly what causes the measurable effect. And they split the groups they split the study into three groups. One was supposed to do it as instructed. One was supposed to not touch the meridians at all and just repeat the affirmations as many times as a person going through the meridians would. And the third group had to tap all the meridians but on a doll.
Ah, not on themselves.
Not on themselves, but on a doll. And they found that the second group that did not use any kind of physical stimulus at all, and I don't remember what exactly the study was. It would be a lot more interesting if I did. I think it had something to do with addictions or anxiety, one of those things that are pretty easy to measure. And the people who used no physical stimulus, very little benefit compared to the ones who tapped the meridians. But the ones who tapped the doll got exactly the same benefit, which made me think about exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. So perhaps it's the act of doing this silly, primitive, weird ritual that you don't understand that makes you disengage your rational mind and allow the emotional mind to actually take in that message that you repeat out vocally.
Yeah. Sounds very similar. And that's the power of nonsense at work.
Hooray.
Yes. I was almost going to say high five, but I don't think it's quite a high five moment yet.
Okay. We can high five.
That sounded so
good. Come on, let's high five. Come on, yeah.
It's not quite a high five moment.
I was feeling we might get to higher.
Okay.
I guess we've raised the tone.
Yes, so. We could edit this high five out. It's fine. No one has to know we high fived now.
We high five too early.
You can edit it so we don't even have to do the next high five.
You could drop it in,
you could just say insert high five here.
Except the power of having an editor.
Okay, so the Kabbalah and your own experience was the Vipassana retreat. That's where we kind of like came in with the recording. So you went up on a Vipassana retreat. Does one have to have any kind of practical skills to participate in a Vipassana retreat?
You should be able to breathe and you can't have clinical depression. So it's pretty basic, really.
Yeah.
You don't have to be able to sit in a lotus position or something like that.
No, in fact, well, I mean, a lotus position I find very painful to sit in meditation long term. No, and there were people there across the entire age spectrum. So people who had problems sitting for a long time, they brought a meditation stool, some of them. And people who really had back problems or some kind of back problems that gave rise during the workshop were given kind of special permission to meditate on a chair, although you're not supposed to, I guess. Yeah.
And how long was it?
You arrive at a meditation center, and I think from the day you arrive until the day you leave, it's 11 days. But it's 10 days of the intense workshop itself. And I think upon arriving very early on, you take a vow of silence. At least in Israel, where I did the first two workshops, I did Vipassana three times. So two times the 10-day seminar, and one more time for a short 3-day seminar, which our only advanced students are allowed to take. And the first two times I did in Israel, I heard that just because Israelis have a strong rebellious streak, when you have to enforce any kind of rule, you really have to put your foot down. So when Israelis arrive at the center, they have to give their phones. They have to give, you're not allowed to smoke, so you have to give away your cigarettes. They have to give it. Whereas I heard that if you do a Vipassana meditation retreat here in Germany, they just trust you. They just like say, please don't use your phone. And good old Germans are like, okay. And then they don't, apparently.
Compulsively following orders.
Yeah.
That's a German trait, yeah.
Yeah, for better and for worse.
Coming back to the Vipassana retreat, you mentioned you've been to even a couple of them. What is your personal subjective experience of what happens during the retreat and then also maybe the consequences and effects after?
Sure. I think a lot of people, they have a reason why they go, you know. The first time I went, I was just in an emotionally difficult place. The second time, I had a big life decision that I wanted to make and I wanted to get clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like when you're surrounded by life and the distractions, it's just hard to find your own center. So at least that was the goal I came in both times, is to find a true, more meaningful, deep me that I would be able to count on, that when I've made those decisions, I made them with a clear slate. The first thing you do when you go to Vipassana is basically people go there, or they can go there without any knowledge at all of meditation. it's a very aggressive way to learn meditation, you know, because after you arrive, during the 10 days, you're expected to meditate for about 10 hours a day. And it's not guided meditation in the sense that every second you hear someone's voice telling you what to do. There is a bit of guidance, of course there is, but a lot of times you're just sitting in a room by yourself, being quiet. And that can be difficult, you know? The first thing they do when you get there is to teach you a form of meditation called Anapana, I believe is the name. So every meditation has an object of focus, and in Anapana you focus on your breath. So you're not supposed to control your breath, you're supposed to just observe your breath naturally come in and out, which nostril it comes in and out, how warm or cold it is, what speed it is. And every time you notice your awareness move away from your breath to something else, you are supposed to gently, without being angry at yourself for having lost your focus, bring back your awareness to your breath. And that is a lot more challenging than it sounds, because one of the first things a non-experienced meditator realizes when they start meditating is that we actually have no control at all of our mind. And that's a very disturbing thing to come across, because you always think to yourself that you are focusing and directing your mind to think certain things, and then you just realize that even when you're trying to make it think about nothing, you're trying to focus it on something very simple and there are no distractions whatsoever. You're engrossed in your own world, in your own past, future, fears, insecurities, memories, all these things that are just constantly coming up to the surface. I could equate in many ways Vipassana to fasting on the physical sense, where when you don't input anything into your physical system, the body automatically starts cleansing itself out, or at least that's what people believe, many people, including myself, and a lot of the toxins come out. And in a very real way, when you have no input in Vipassana, all of your...
On a mental level.
On a mental and emotional and spiritual level, when there's just nothing, you know? You don't have friends, you don't have family, you don't have no one, you're just not connected to anything, and everything that you have is just the current moment, then you just realize, okay, this is what's left when I'm all by myself and there's still a lot of shit. And then it just starts coming up to the surface. So the first 3.5 days are just Anapana, and you learn this technique. And after a couple of days, it's not the biggest thing that changes after a couple of days, at least for me and for, I believe, for a lot of beginning meditators, is that they start by getting less angry at themselves every time they need to change their awareness back to the breath. Mm-hmm. Because initially I was very, very frustrated. I'm like, fuck, again I lost it. And it wasn't even something good. I was just thinking about like a toy that I got when I was a kid. Or just weird shit, you know. I'd be thinking about how the McDonald's in my neighborhood looked like.
Yeah. Did you regret at any point during the experience?
You know, I think I did. It has been a while. You know, I did the first one in 2003 and the last one in 2005 or 6. So it's been a long while, really. Yeah, there's always that, but then you just remind yourself. And the big thing in Vipassana is reminding yourself about the nature of transience. You know, they have a word for it in Pali, which is an ancient Indian language. And it's called Anicca. Anicca. And every person who has done Vipassana will remember that word, because it basically means everything will come and go. Anicca. Mm-hmm. Everything is transient. And so it's pretty hard to go to a Vipassana retreat and really immerse yourself into it and then at the same time think, why am I here? Because if you really did it right and you blocked off a block of time where you don't have anything to do, and you're like, okay, well, even if I'm feeling uncomfortable with this experience, if I believe that it is for the greater good, then whatever discomfort I'm feeling right now being here will go away.
Sure.
And so that's the second part of Vipassana, is when you start focusing on the actual technique, which is more just going through and focusing on various areas of your body and feeling the tension and then just moving on. And just moving on with awareness, back and forth, back and forth. And yeah, and then you do that for the last 6.5 days, mm-hmm. pretty much with no further... It doesn't get a lot deeper than what it got after they explained it to you.
Right.
But the experience itself gets a lot deeper, a lot deeper. So you're basically like opening up a wound and a lot of shit comes up to the surface, and then it starts healing. So it's kind of like an operation. It's a spiritual operation. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would recommend it to everyone. And I think it leaves a lot of people, including myself, a little bit confused. It left me a little bit confused last time I did it.
Here's an interesting...
Yeah, this is...
Or maybe interesting question. So one of the characteristics is you have basically no input, right?
That's
so
right.
Do you also have like no output because you're not allowed to talk?
That's right.
Are you allowed to, for example, let's say...
Read and write? No.
Yeah, write down your thoughts or empty your mind with any kind of...
At least back when I did it, you're not supposed to. I just read an account a few days ago about a lady who did a Vipassana retreat here in Germany, and she mentioned that she did take some notebooks with her.
Okay.
And so that she was writing daily, but we were specifically told not to write back when I did it. And I remember that was frustrating for me because... One of the weird things that started happening is, and I can't really explain it, but I had an entire story write itself out in my head as I was going to sleep every night. Like every night in the second time I did Vipassana, I couldn't sleep for 2 hours, even though it was very long days and we're waking up at 6 and going to sleep at 10 and just meditating all, and I just wanted to sleep, but still, this story would write itself in my head. It's just like this bomb of creative energy that exploded. And I wished that I had like a pen and paper, but every day I would try to like keep it in mind, like to try to, okay, so this is what happens. And then this guy does this. And then and this is how this story ends. And I would add characters. And then when I went back to reality, I started writing it. But yeah, you're completely not allowed to output anything either.
Okay.
Yeah, you were saying about how you came out of it and you're a bit confused.
Mm-hmm.
So I was interested to explore like what happened after the meditation.
The thing is, I think Vipassana is problematic in how demanding it is, how demanding they really are of the people that do it to keep a path of spiritual practice. Because I found it to be overwhelmingly positive. But then on the last day of the workshop, they basically said, okay, well, from now on, and for the next year, just to really get a strong foundation for your practice, you need to practice meditation for 2 hours a day. So 1 hour in the morning and 1 hour in the evening. And I find that very, very hard to do, very hard to achieve, and a very big thing to ask of someone. And I think most people failed. I only know one person who actually succeeded in doing it, and I met him over a year after doing Vipassana, and he was something else. He was like an elevated saint. He was completely pure and clean and very, very nice, very spiritually refined. You know, he was avoiding all toxins and even sex, you know, so he got to a different level, which is cool, but I couldn't follow up with it. You kind of feel... When you leave Vipassana, you feel really beautifully emotionally and spiritually clean.
Mm.
And then you come back to the world and shit just starts pouring in again and feels bad. You feel like, wow, I was really at a good place and now this is happening again. And because the daily practice is so hard to reach, at least for where I was, I found it very frustrating. I felt like I've achieved something and then lost it. I found it to be sad because it was such a good feeling to have been so centered. And then to realize that you can't really do it in daily life, or I couldn't, or I wouldn't, you should say. You know, I didn't make it enough of a priority over other things. And even when I did, I think for about 2 months, I managed to keep that daily practice. And I still compared it to the experience before, which you're really not supposed to do with meditation.
Mm.
It's not about how you feel. It's just about observing. Mm. You know, it's just about letting things be as they are. So... Yeah, I think it left me quite confused, and I've explored a lot of other spiritual paths since then. And one of the things that I strongly believe now is that a spiritual path has to be accessible and flexible. And, you know, you should be able to enter, take with little success spirals, you know, just do a small thing and expand it over time.
You even kept up the routine or the discipline for another 2 months. I think that's already impressive. But I also totally get the 1 hour in the morning, 1 hour in the evening is like a very hard thing to do. I mean, for it depends. I have been, like, for the last couple of years, been in a relationship. So I think this is also, like, I have been doing more meditation when I was single still. And it's something weird to live together with somebody. And either you kind of, like, convince them to do the same, they follow the same kind of practice. Or you always have to do this kind of artificial separation, like, okay, so I'm gonna go off meditating. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't need to be something spiritual. It's the same if you say, like, I'm gonna go off exercising and I'm gonna go whatever. But if you take these slots of time that you then basically
exclude your partner.
You claim that 1 hour in the morning where you shouldn't be disturbed or anything.
Right.
But that's one thing. And then also, like, you did this, followed this discipline for 2 months and then you gave it up, which I can also totally relate to. And then there are so many accounts on the internet nowadays where people talk about how you should create habits and all that kind of, you know, the whole how to create habits and change yourself. And a lot of people say if you follow something for 30 days, not even to mention like 2 months, it should already be something that you never lose again.
That's nonsense.
That's what I feel.
I feel that that's a load of rubbish.
But there's like, you even, I just recently saw a video on meditation, an interview with Ray Dalio. And he also says the same thing, like you would just have to do it for certain number of days. I think like he quoted, like, if you do it like for 2 months, he says, like, it's like exercise, it's never gonna go away from you or whatever. And maybe this is a price that we pay. Like, if we change, you know, cities, places we live, accommodation, and so on and so forth, all kind of everything that we would be able to take with us or keep on practicing would have to be something that's really easily accessible.
Back to meditation.
Yeah.
So that thing you were saying about having practiced for 2 months and then kind of falling off the wagon, so to speak.
Yeah.
But then seeing this other guy who kind of gone into some Zen realm and stopped having sex.
He seems very happy, by the way.
I'm actually
very, very happy.
As I was saying in a previous conversation, I've kind of been in that realm myself.
Yeah.
You know, I've done some meditation retreats and a lot of meditation, and also gone to a place where I was no longer interested in sex.
Sure.
But I'm now, you know, back down to earth with all the dirty people.
Yeah. Good to have you.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back. One thing I would say is I felt like it was disillusionment that was keeping me there. Like, there were things that I was missing out, and I was kind of making excuses. I'd have like these beliefs that what I was doing was was sort of holy kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I had this kind of explanations in my mind as to why it was okay that I wouldn't do that kind of thing, or why it was okay that I would have these kind of ostensibly problems, but I'd turn them around into being kind of, you know, strengths and,
spiritual ego, one would say.
Yeah. To make this longer story short, my kind of sort of conclusion on the issue was, you've got to go into the trenches. You've got to kind of go out there in normal life and take what you've got from that retreat and practice that whilst it's messy and dirty and it's you in real life. Because that situation in the retreat is a very special, rare circumstance, you know, in nature, in normal human life, let alone nature. That kind of 10 days is, you know, virtually impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, completely.
Dealing with the day-to-day world.
Okay. Is that the question?
Yeah. That's where we've moved this conversation to.
I see.
I'll pass the baton to you.
All right. Baton taken, dear listeners. I remember coming back from the workshop, and just as I came back from the first workshop, pretty much walking on clouds, there was a little bit of crisis at home. And the crisis was, my little brother was back in the day, he's 23 now, so he would have been 13, about 12 or 13 back then. And back in the day, he was very much into basketball, and my parents, to encourage him, they enrolled him into like a varsity team, or like he was part of the Young Maccabi team in Israel. They were just practicing a lot.
And then I think just as I came back, he decided that he doesn't want to do it anymore. I'm a pretty kind of like loving person, but I'm not very nurturing, you know? But just I came back then and everyone was angry in their own way, you know? You could feel like the tension in the house, you know? My mom was washing the dishes, but she was washing them with anger. You know, she was really scrubbing them when they were clean, you know? And I remember like walking in the kitchen and like relaxing her and saying, look, I know you guys put a lot of time and effort into this, but at the end of the day, it's his life and he gets to decide what he does with it. And maybe he'll come back to it, you know, maybe he'll still go and join like basketball team later. But, and pretty much the same thing with my dad, who was angry for his own reasons and similar reasons to my mom, you know, they just felt like they gave him a lot and then he just decided to drop out of it. And then I went into my brother's room and he was faking being asleep, right? So that my mom and dad don't pester him. But he had to keep the act going with me, right? Because he didn't know if I'm a double agent or not. So I just sat down on the side of his bed and I said, listen, buddy, I know you're asleep, right? I know you're asleep, but I'm going to say this anyway. I'm really proud of you for making your own mind, your own decision. And just so you know, I'll support you in whatever you do. Whatever is going on right now is not going to last, so don't be too worried about it. And I think looking back, that kind of behavior is definitely not something that I would do on a normal day-to-day life. And I don't know how much it even helped, to be honest, but like I would usually take a step back and I'd be like, you know, things are going to take their course. But I remember just feeling so elevated, so like I had so much to give and I had so much capacity to endure other people's emotional pain. And then, yeah, after that, the second time after I've done it, I was in university. In the beginning of the second semester, I took 10 days off to go to this Vipassana retreat. And I had other people submitting papers in my name, you know, so that I didn't miss my homework stuff. And I came back, and every time I felt like a little bit distracted or God knows, or a little bit uncomfortable, I just wanted so much to go back to that purity that I just sat down and closed my eyes and started meditating. And I think that's a little bit socially weird, you know, because that happens quite a lot.
I think we're coming up to another high five moment because I've always been doing that, meditating or doing Tai Chi in socially weird situations.
Yeah, Chris can do that. But quick question to the retreat and what happened after. Earlier, you said that everybody goes into the retreat with some kind of, what did you call it, like a cause or like a question?
A reason, a cause.
Yeah, so everybody has a reason. Let's say, okay, did you resolve, if that's the right word, right terminology, your reason through the retreat? And if so, more like during the retreat or after? Like what was that like? Like did something happen like on the seventh day or?
The first time I went to the retreat, I went because something unexpectedly bad happened in my life, and I was having a hard time dealing with the repercussions of my life. But realistically, looking from the side, nothing too bad happened. It was just I planned on doing something and life had another plan, and life's plan is what ended up happening. And so I was sitting there on the side really resisting what has become of my life, and just thinking, where would I be if I didn't make some mistakes and I still could have been able to do what I wanted to do, rah, 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 rah. And I think going to meditation really helped me release that and understand that my life is not going to go in that direction. And any energy I put into this illusionary direction is just an illusion, you know? It's something that I thought would happen, didn't happen, and there's no parallel future in which it will happen. So I had to focus on what is in my life, and then planning on what I want to do next based on what is real. So it helped me let go of illusion, really. The second time I had to make a big decision, and the big decision, I don't mind sharing that, I wasn't sure about whether or not I wanted to go to Australia to study as a student, because I also knew the repercussions would be that I could potentially stay in Australia later on and it would be a big thing. It would be basically me leaving Israel, and I knew that that could happen. And I remember thinking to myself, am I just doing this out of escape or do I really want to do this? And that's the question I really came back with. And I said, if I finish the retreat And I still want to go to Australia because I really did, but I didn't know if it was just coming out of a place of weakness, of not liking my current circumstances, or out of a place of, I want to explore, and, you know, kind of like putting a positive spin on it. I wanted to see if in my deepest core I would still want to do it, or maybe doing the meditation and actually clearing up some shit, surface level shit, I'll get to a point where I'm like, huh, you know what, I am happy with this life, and, you know, it's a little bit frustrating here, but I'll just keep meditating daily and I'll be able to take it. It was one of those breaks where I'm like, okay, if I finish it and I don't want to go, maybe I won't go, but I still wanted to go. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those things that pushed me to go, and yeah, I'm very happy with that decision.
So taking this a little further, maybe away from the concrete specific Vipassana meditation and the retreat, sure. Can you describe a little bit what your practical spiritual solution, ideal solution, either already is or should look like?
Yeah,
ingredients.
I've explored a lot. I think I mentioned a few of that. I've explored emotional freedom technique and breath work. I've done an ayahuasca workshop, and there was a period where I was indulging in some yoga. I guess that wasn't that serious, but the best thing I found is relatively unknown, I have to say, a book by a guy called Michael Brown, and it's called The Presence Process. And it's kind of a how-to manual on all of Eckhart Tolle's work, where Eckhart Tolle speaks a lot about presence, but he doesn't really speak about the daily practice of presence.
Mm-hmm. Because you already got it.
Well, yeah, he's there, you know, and he says that he kind of like lives it, so it's hard for him to explain how to do it. And also, you know, when you get someone into a practice, it's really important to do it experientially rather than just writing, oh, you know what, you guys, if you get lost, and I think he does mention that, Eckhart Tolle, he says, if you get lost, here's a couple of gateways back to the present. So he says, the breath, your body, the moment, you know, but it's so vague.
Yeah, it's like two pages in the book or something.
It's so vague that you just think to yourself, okay, so I have this list, but when exactly do I do this? Do I do this every day? Do I do this when I get to a point of crisis? How, I mean, at least for me, I need more of a method, and then I practice it. And so Michael Brown, The Presence Process, first off, there's a lot of very, very original material there. Some very unique points of view, and I've read quite a lot of you know, I don't know if I should call it Western spirituality, but like the Western take on Eastern spirituality and mindfulness, and his take is completely different. What he speaks about is presence as a way of balancing your emotional state rather than imbalancing your mind, which I feel most meditation is about. A lot of meditation is about bringing peacefulness to the mind, where he talks about presence as being present to what you feel at any given moment. And the daily practice is actually very, very simple, which I like, because in meditation there's always that feeling, even though you know you shouldn't do it, but at the end of it you feel like, did I manage to focus or did I not manage to focus? Did I manage to like get myself into a place of calmness, or was my mind all over the place?
Did I reach my goals?
Yeah.
Meditation goals.
Yeah. Did like, whereas really, like, as any meditator knows, or at least knows on a logical level, rational level, just sitting down and doing meditation or trying is enough. That is the goal. Mm. But still, somehow it doesn't feel that way.
Mm.
With the presence process, the only thing that's required of you is to sit down for 15 minutes twice a day, first thing in the morning and last thing at night, and to connect your breath. So make sure that there is no space between your ingoing breath and your outgoing breath, and to breathe out of the nose. And that's pretty much it. That's the only thing. So
it's pretty interesting, because I just thought about another kind of a presence technique that does exactly the opposite. It's where you're supposed to inhale and then hold your breath for count to three or something, and then exhale. And the whole reason why you do that is because it's so unnatural, or not what, you know, organically happens. You have to intentionally do it. So as long as you do it, you are present to your breath, and you're not just letting it go in and out. It's really interesting that you could take it the other way around and just have it as smooth as possible.
It's actually not But you do become present to your breath in a way, but what you really become present to is your emotional state.
Okay, so
which is really interesting and really beautiful, because you start to realize that there's stuff going on there that you might be pushing under the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you connect your breath, it just naturally comes up, especially the really strong stuff. Now, if you do it while you're reading the book, it actually gives you a weekly focus, just like a weekly thing to focus about. And then it gives it a lot more power. So the presence process itself is a 10-week process.
Okay.
And it goes deeper and deeper and deeper, even though the daily practice is almost exactly the same.
Okay.
And it's very, very subtle. It's very subtle. Like Vipassana is very, it's overpowering. It's very strong. It's too much. And then it leaves you with an experience that can't be maintained in daily life. Whereas this is just, I think the 10 weeks of the presence process are worth a lot more than 10 days in Vipassana, just because it's such a simple, small thing that you could easily integrate in your life.
Okay.
It's like
easily
success spirals you've been talking
exactly.
about. Introducing yeah. small things, small attainable goals.
Exactly.
A spiral of gradually increasing, is that the idea?
Yeah, a success spiral is an idea set about by psychologists that if you want to succeed in something, start by a small success. So start by doing it successfully, but like a miniaturized, smaller version with less, smaller difficulty level or a shorter time span than what you eventually plan to do it, and then gradually increase.
Yeah.
And the fact that you've done, that you've put in consistent action over time is enough to create more of a motivation and more of a sense of achievement.
You know, the feeling that it's succeeding each time. Gives you this kind of positive reinforcement.
Yes, completely.
To your power.
So I just wanted to finish on saying this about the presence process, because it sounds very airy fairy and up in the air. There's something very real about your breath and how it connects to your emotional state. When someone is afraid, for example, they seem to take in more in breaths than out breaths. You know, just think about that. It's kind of like it sounds like.
Yeah.
Or maybe no. Maybe that's more associated with sadness. You know, like.
Yeah.
And then when someone is angry, it's completely the opposite. They breathe out more. It's like
and then
when someone is afraid, usually they completely
they're not breathing,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the things that happen when you force yourself to connect the breath, all of those emotions that in a way get locked in. This is very hard to explain, but the pattern of breathing actually keeps them locked in and unprocessed in the body. And in the mind and in the emotional and spiritual realm, they start becoming integrated.
So if I get this right, you're saying that, for example, like being afraid or being in a state of fear seems to cause a certain kind of breathing.
Mm-hmm.
You could also say that you can't experience the fear that you're having whilst you're not breathing in the appropriate way.
I think you can't process it. So you can't
process it.
You can't. I can give you an example for something unprocessed, okay? This is a very harsh example, and one of the things they say in the presence process is, and again, this is almost like me speaking about my mom's Kabbalah book, because this is completely irrational, but they say that as you start doing the 10 weeks of the presence process, the universe is going to start testing you, and they're going to give you situations that you completely don't expect, just so you would be able to have the opportunity to process them emotionally and get like into a deeper sense of emotional understanding with yourself. And so I've had a friend back then, I think he was suffering from some depression. And then as I was doing the presence process, he sent me a text message one day at like 12 a.m. at night. And he said in the text message, thank you for being a great inspiration. By the time you read this tomorrow, I'll be dead. And I was thinking to myself, okay, this is a cry for help if there's ever been one, you know? And he was living pretty close by to me. So obviously I drove my car at the same time. I called emergency services to come to his house. I went into his house and the door was open and he was there in his room. And I think he had a couple of boxes of Valium and whiskey, like half a bottle of whiskey that he drank. And I think he was trying to commit suicide, obviously. And I think he thought that would be the way to do it. He was completely not lucid. And at the same time, I remember myself being very practical, you know? I was just thinking, okay, maybe I'll just get him to throw up. Maybe the Valium that he has in his system, he should have less of it. And I remember talking about it with him. And then this thought popped into my head and I was thinking to myself, despite everything that I'm doing here, this could be the last moments that this guy is alive ever. His father may want to hear how his last moments sound like. So I took my phone, my iPhone, and I turned on the recorder, and then I put it back in my pocket, just so that those moments were kind of recorded, that conversation. And then after about 10 minutes, and he wouldn't throw up, and emergency services came over, and they took him to the hospital. And then they said, thank you so much for being a good friend, blah, blah, blah. And then I went home, and I slept like a baby. And that's weird. It was 12 a.m. By the time I came back from his place, after emergency services took him away, it was 1 a.m. And I went home and slept like a baby. And that's bizarre, because while I was at his place, I could feel myself being completely numb, not feeling any emotion whatsoever, because I just knew that I had a goal, I had something to take care of, you know? It's kind of like if you think about a funny joke when you're at a funeral, you don't allow yourself to laugh. You mm-hmm. leave it for later, and then you laugh about it later. And I think that's what the process of suppressing emotion was really all about, what it's supposed to be used in the manual, you know? It's kind of like you have an emotion right now, now is not the right time to deal with it, you deal with it later. And I remember myself thinking, okay, I'm doing this presence process every day. I can feel that there is a big fucking chunk here that's locked, that I'm not feeling anything. When I think about this guy, I'm not feeling good or bad or sad. I'm just feeling numb.
So this whole episode took place whilst you were practicing?
Yeah, while I was doing the presence process, and even after the end of my practice. But the next day when I woke up, I did my next practice. And, you know, he obviously came to mind. I was thinking about him, but I could not access into that emotion. And every time I was thinking about contacting him, I didn't do it out of a place of real compassion. I did it out of a place of putting a mask on and thinking, okay, I don't feel anything, but what would a good friend do in this situation? I was acting the role of a good friend because something happened, you know, that experience was traumatic and something happened to me. And I was trying to reach, like, logically, I was trying to think to myself, like, what am I feeling about this guy? Am I feeling sad that all of this happened? Am I feeling angry that he chose to call me? Am I feeling afraid that he might do it again? What exactly am I feeling? And I just, even though I sat down in practice, I couldn't do it. And then one day I just decided to go back to that recording that I had on my phone. And by the way, he ended up fine. But I decided to go back to that recording I had on my phone and listen to it, because it sat on my phone like for a week, and I remembered it being there, and it was just the elephant in the phone, you know? It's just, you don't want to think about it, but it's there, and you don't want to listen to it because it's horrible, but you still have to one day, you know? You got to do something with it, either delete it or do whatever. And I decided to listen to it, but while I was listening to it, I decided to do the presence process breathing kind of thing. I put the headphones on and I started listening to the recording, and it was very clear, and I could hear everything that's going on. I could hear me and I could hear him. And the second I heard it, I was thrown back into that moment, and I could feel the blood rushing in my veins, and everything was very real. And I was feeling what I was supposed to feel, what was going on for me that night, but I wasn't feeling all the stuff that I put under the surface, but I was feeling it. I was allowing myself to process it. And as I was breathing, suddenly, like, I was taken over by this huge feeling of sadness. And I was just, I really understood what I felt. And the sadness came from thinking, this is a good friend of mine, and I don't want him to leave. Like, I would like for him to stay around. This, and it started connecting to all other people before in my life that I had to say goodbye to. Whether it was a breakup or someone who passed away or moving to other countries. And it connected to so many things because it was the same emotional blueprint. But it was just a very deep, meaningful moment. And I started crying in the middle of doing that practice. But it integrated everything. And after that, I could feel for him again. I was sitting next to him and I didn't feel like I was being fake. And so that's what I mean by emotional integration. And that's a kind of, I don't know if you have someone in your life where, and I hope you don't because it's a bad feeling, but someone in your life where if you saw them in the street, you would feel like you'd have to cross the street because you're very inauthentic when you're next to that person.
Yeah.
Because the feeling of being yourself next to that person is unbearable because you don't like the way you are around them. But if you are, it's very likely that there's some unprocessed shit around there. And if you solve that shit, you could be authentic again next to that person. And so that's what I talk about when I talk about the presence process. And I think that emotional integration, which is very different from meditation. Meditation is so much about the mind, and this is so much about the heart and the emotional body. It's just something that you can feel. It's very real. Yeah. And I really highly, highly recommend that book to everyone. And I really hope that Oprah picks it up, because that's the kind of book that could really make a difference for tons of people. And the guy deserves huge credit, because he created an amazing
the presence
work.
Process.
The Presence Process by Michael Brown.
Well, I'm going to be reading that.
Please. Me too. Yeah. Me too. So has that been like an ongoing thing for you then? Or did you experience, like, did you go through a whole bunch of different emotions similar to, maybe not as dramatic, but similar to what you subscribe? Because I have to make a confession here. I'm probably not in a really good, I don't have a good connection to my emotional states, I guess. And I just want to put that as a disclaimer, that emotions are not my greatest field of expertise. Maybe I should put it like this.
That's fine.
Obviously, I have them, but I also tend to over the emotional.
I think you explained it really succinctly with you and your girlfriend, how she's really up and down and happy and angry and sad. And you just kind of stay around the middle. You're like a kind of stabilizing force. I imagine maybe you do that with your emotions. You kind of sort of stabilize them a bit.
A bit. Apart from that more dramatical episode that you talked about, did you go through a lot of emotions like sadness and what through?
Yes. I actually went through a lot of sadness and anger, and not that much fear, because he talks about the basic three emotions. And he said they all come from sadness, and then a layer around sadness is anger. So anger is kind of like a way to protect yourself from sadness. It's like, no, fuck off.
Yeah.
Fuck off, like you can't come close. And I think around that comes fear, or maybe around sadness comes fear, and then anger is a way of like dealing, so you don't even have to experience that fear. But they're all the same. It's just how deep you go into them. So I think I experienced quite a lot of sadness and anger, which are two feelings that if people who know me don't really associate with me. You know, I'm a pretty happy guy. I'm a pretty chilled out guy. But I think as part of having that as my identity, I don't allow myself to experience those emotions. And it's important. Your shadow side is very much a part of you. And one of the things he talks about as a presence process, I think every week has a small little mission that might seem unrelated, but is very much related. And I think on one of the weeks, he said, find a picture of yourself when you were 3 or 5 or whatnot, and just look at that picture and say, I love you to that boy or girl in the picture. I remember doing that, and suddenly it all clicked in my mind that all of this, the emotional body that I've been focusing on, all these feelings of good and bad, that's very much connects to something else that... like a theory in psychology that has something to do with Gestalt theory, which is the inner child. And I very much felt like how all of these emotions are being experienced by a very young, naive version of myself that doesn't really understand the world.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I am a responsible adult, and I have to play parent to that side of myself. You know, you have these dialogues you have with yourself when you have to go through a scary situation, for example, or a hard situation. Usually it starts from a place of, let's say, you have your inner voice that says something like, I don't want to do this. I'm afraid. I don't want to do this. This is too hard. Rah, rah. And then based on how you judge that voice to be is going to be your inner response. Now, I find a lot of people, they give the image they give to that voice is an image of someone higher than them. So like a judge, a boss, an inner parent. Whereas I look at it and I think that's the inner child.
Mm.
And you would deal very differently with an inner boss than you would with an inner child. Because if it's your inner boss and he says, you know, you want to do something crazy that's scary to you, you know, and you want to go travel around the world, and your inner judge, right, is telling you, you can't do it.
Mm.
You can't do it. And then you're like, fuck you. I can't do it. Shut up. I can do it. Don't tell me what to do. You can't tell me. You know, because that's how you feel like when someone else with more power than you is trying to take authority over your life. But if you actually put the image that this is yourself as a child saying that, and they're not actually saying it in the voice you give it to them. They're not saying, you can't do it. They're like saying, I can't do it. I can't do it. And then if you just think to yourself, okay, I'm there is no parent, no one is coming to save me. You know, I have to be the responsible adult for myself, for my emotional side. Then you can say something like, I know this is scary, but this is going to pass. And we've done a lot of things like this before. And it always worked out. And you know that you can trust me because I have your best interest in mind. And I'm always going to keep listening to you. And if it gets too hard, then we'll back off. But you can trust me because I think it's going to be okay. And I'll take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
And so at least for me, that's a much more nurturing, a much more healthy inner dialogue to have with yourself. I think that's what I really kept with myself since the presence process, that when I feel something, I really have this dialogue with myself, but with a lot less resistance, you know?
I see.
just very much listening to the side and not expecting it to change because it won't change.
Yeah.
Because a child won't change, you know? You could, if you want to take a child onto a roller coaster and they're afraid because they see other people going on the roller coaster and yelling and screaming, you could say, come on, let's go, come on. And they'd be screaming all the way in the roller coaster and they'd be screaming in the roller coaster. And then when they get off, they trust you a little less because you made them go through all of that.
Mm.
Or you could say, you know what? I know this looks scary, but it's actually okay. It's actually really safe. And if you allow yourself to feel that, then you might be able to enjoy it. And trust me, it's going to be fine.
Because I have you, exactly. Nurturing yourself.
Yes, because I have your best interests at heart. And
I
really like that. And actually, that's not something that I read in the book. That's more something that I developed out of it. But to me, that feels like the best kind of model of dealing with your emotional body that I could relate to. When I hear people speaking to themselves negatively, to me, that's child abuse in a way, because they're talking that way into a very soft part of themselves that would just take anything that they say and accept it.
Yeah, child abuse.
Yeah.
I think following on that point of abuse, I think you always have this point where you can make a decision to be positive or negative about something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, that's your choice of what you do with your thoughts. And I guess, you know, when you veer towards the negative side, you know, that's the child abuse category. And I guess that's the bane of being human, is you have this kind of two choices. Am I negative about this or am I positive about this?
Sure. But I've seen people who they have a very high level of self-discipline, for example. Mm-hmm. And again, like when I see them, I'm thinking this is the kind of the way they speak to themselves, the way their parents spoke to them. I've got a friend who's really, really into sports, ridiculously into sports, and he looks the part, you know? He has an amazing body, very, very fit. And I think one day we were traveling, we're on the road together, and we couldn't do sports, it was too late. And the level of self-hate that he had towards himself that day was amazing to me. And I was thinking, okay, so he really deals with himself in a way of punishing himself, you know? Like, if he doesn't do the thing that he promised himself, then he punishes himself by just being nasty to himself, so...
Yeah, I was totally like that.
Yeah.
I've been very disciplined and...
Yeah.
I'd get up 6 a.m, do my meditation, do my kung fu, and, you know, Nico can attest to my levels of physical discipline, and dietary discipline, and all those things. And I would have a big sense of guilt or negativity if I didn't reach my mark. But in recent years, I've mellowed a lot and realized that this is a kind of abuse, self-abuse. And now, you know, I'll lie in, stay in bed, eat some chips, you know. Which to most people sounds like, what are you talking about? That's just normal.
Yeah.
But for the disciplinarian who's kind of got this real whip behind them, you know, it's... that's quite a big deal. That's kind of falling off the horse.
Yeah.
Mm. But so what about getting in touch with your more like the positive emotions? Or is there never going to be a problem with that at all? I mean, I think it's the same thing because as Chris just said, like if the emotions are oftentimes metaphorically like the roller coaster ride, the ups and the highs and ups and downs. How do you increase your capacity to enjoy something or to feel joy or to you know, like Did your capacity to experience positive emotions?
I think yes.
Improve as
well? I think yes, and so it really depends on what you think the natural behavior for a human is, and I think humans naturally veer towards positive emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really were to experience the universe as it is without any mental or emotional filters, you would be overjoyed all day long, just like Eckhart Tolle is. He's just sitting there and he's always blissing out, you know, just like talking slow and he's loving life. And so I really do think that it's a matter of removing filters to feeling like that. At least for me, that's been my experience. Now, having said that, you know, there are still things right now, there are things that I do in my life that I know are not creating any happiness in the short term. You know, for example, my business, you guys have heard how I speak about my business. But not just that. It's very much, you know, there's not really a spiritual connect there. And, you know, and I'm having these discussions within myself of like, listen there, inner child, we are going to make sure that we are financially secure, and then you could be, and then you could be a little bit more free.
Then you can help the pigeons.
Yeah, then you could help the pigeons. Then, then you could produce the world's best Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
And write a blog about it.
Yeah.
And so even though right now I'm not on a path where every day I feel like completely connected to myself spiritually and to my mission in life, you know, you could say that I'm reacting to some things that happened to me in the past. You know, I've spent some time having financial problems and I'm still getting used to having some financial comfort, and I want to make sure that those financial problems never occur again. I feel like I'm doing a smart thing, you know, for myself and for my future. But I'm very much aware of how disconnected I am from full joy, from full bliss.
Okay.
You know, and that's a compromise that I'm willing to take right now. So in a way,
it's
I know.
Work in progress.
Say what?
It's work in progress.
It's a work in progress, exactly. But I know the things that make me happy, and usually I gravitate towards them naturally. And sometimes, despite knowing what would make me happy, for various reasons, and sometimes I choose to put logic in front of emotion or in front of spirit, just because it's a complex world, you know, and you can't live life just out of a spiritual prism, just out of an emotional prism. So I choose to put logic, the way my brain sees it, in front of the way my heart or my spirit sees it. And I live with the consequences, but I know that that's my choice. That's a choice I'm making, and I take full responsibility for it. Does that answer your question?
Totally.
Good. Yeah. I think the first thing you said just about filtering out until you're left with what's there already, which is the joy.
Yeah.
I think that's a fairly common notion. It's, you don't need to work on the happiness. It's more like kind of, like we were saying in the last episode about taking things away which are blocking you, rather than looking at putting the things in that you want. It's kind of like they're there. They're just waiting for you.
Mm. And as a little remark, I want to add that even though you have spent some time with Elmok over the last couple of months in Berlin, I have met you for the first time today.
A few hours ago.
Just a few hours ago. And I'm just thinking, he did a really great job to come off as a smart, semi-enlightened, financially successful, independent entrepreneur.
Attractive.
Yeah, so I'm already like
more than just a baritone voice, ladies.
Totally.
He's not paying us for this speech.
I'm not.
I have no problem with associating my face to this interview.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, I think we should wrap up, guys.
Yeah, we should wrap up.
It's been a really good time.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Marvelous.
Very much.
Anyway, thank you for listening, Herbos, and we'll catch you all next time.
Bye.
Goodbye. Morality morons, pipe dreams, protons, hunting, leaping, jumping, kite surfing, landing pages, optimization, and super.
another amazing Podcast Magic production.